Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
When Charles Ferguson found out his film, Inside Job, had won the Academy Award for Best Documentary last night, he did not start his acceptance speech with the typical platitudes. Instead, he said this.
Forgive me, I must start by pointing out that 3 years after a horrific financial crisis caused by massive fraud, not a single financial executive has gone to jail, and that's wrong.
The film Inside Job looked at the many events that led to the financial crisis of 2008. It looked at the revolving doors between government and Wall Street, Wall Street and academia. It also explained some of the complex financial instruments that were being briskly traded. Robin Young spoke to Charles Ferguson last year when the film first came out.
Charles, let's take credit default swaps. These were those insurance policies against financial instruments failing. But companies like Goldman Sachs began buying the policies because they knew these bundled mortgages would fail, while still selling them to clients. How could Hank Paulson, who went from CEO of Goldman Sachs to George Bush's Treasury Secretary, not know that the whole thing was going to collapse?
That's a very good question. Paulson probably, from what we can tell of the record that we know of when he was at Goldman, probably understood that Goldman and the other investment banks were doing dangerous things that at some point were going to cause significant losses. But one thing that became clear from my research is that nobody, including the government, ever had a complete view of what everybody was doing. And as a result, it was probably difficult or impossible to understand what the full implications and consequences of their behavior would be. And then the other thing to say, of course, is that if you've been in charge of doing this stuff for the previous decade, it's probably a little bit difficult for you to come to the realization that you've just had a major role in destroying the world economy.
Well, but you say nobody knew, but in your film, you know, we're reminded how many people did know. There were a lot of warnings.
It certainly is true that many people understood that what was going on was dangerous, very dangerous, and that at some point it could cause major stresses in the financial system, maybe even a financial collapse. But what nobody could tell, including the people who were warning about it, was exactly when the crisis would occur and exactly how serious it would be. Now, having said that, it is unquestionably true that we would have been better off having a Treasury Secretary who didn't have direct personal culpability for having created this crisis and who had been warning about it and therefore could have a clear conscience and a clear head about how grave and how dangerous it could be. I think there's no question about that.
But perhaps most damning is the portion of your film that's dedicated to the academics, the ways in which business schools and economics departments are themselves complicit. We meet people like Glenn Hubbard, chief economic advisor to George Bush. He's the one who came up with the tax cuts, on the board of MetLife, but also a consultant to firms and dean of Columbia Business School. He wrote a paper. Tell us about the paper that he wrote.
He wrote a paper in 2004, co-wrote it with William C. Dudley, who is now, unfortunately, the president of the New York Federal Reserve, was then the chief economist of Goldman Sachs. And in the paper, they basically describe how wonderful the world is now that we have financial derivatives, which in the paper they claim have reduced financial volatility, made recessions less frequent and less severe when they occur, and are distributing and reducing risk in the financial system. So to put it mildly, they got it wrong.
Well, the problem, as you say, is that Glenn Hubbard wrote that and other papers as an academic without disclosing who his paying clients were. You ask him to make disclosures, and he's not happy. Let's listen.
Who are your consulting clients?
I don't believe I have to discuss that with you.
Okay.
In fact, you have a few more minutes and the interview's over.
Do they include other financial services firms?
Possibly.
You don't remember?
This isn't a deposition, sir. I was polite enough to give you time. Foolishly, I now see, but you have three more minutes. Give it your best shot.
You also spoke to the head of Harvard's economics department.
Does Harvard require disclosures of financial conflict of interest in publications?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you require people to report the compensation they've received from outside activities?
No.
Don't you think that's a problem?
I don't see why.
Martin Feldstein being on the board of AIG, Laura Tyson going on the board of Morgan Stanley, Larry Summers making $10 million a year consulting to financial services firms. Irrelevant.
Basically irrelevant.
Well, let's take Larry Summers, for example. He was Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration, then President of Harvard, then Obama's chief economic advisor. He's now back at Harvard, and a big proponent of deregulations. What is Larry Summers' outside income from his consulting in the financial industry?
Well, Larry Summers made millions of dollars a year when he was at Harvard, including while he was president of Harvard, which, you know, most people would regard as a full-time job, doing two things. He consulted to financial services firms, particularly to one hedge fund, but to others as well. And he also gave speeches to financial services firms, particularly, though not solely, investment banks. And he was paid up to $135,000 per speech. And he made a total of somewhere between $20 and $40 million while he was at Harvard during that period. We don't know exactly how much because there's no disclosure requirement. But unfortunately, it's a little more dangerous than that. These professors, of course, also supervise people who are getting PhDs. They also make hiring decisions. They're on the editorial boards of the major academic journals. And in the case of Martin Feldstein, for a 30-year period, Martin Feldstein was also president of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the largest funder of academic research in economics in the United States. And at the same time, for 20 of those years, he was on the board of AIG, and a foundation controlled by AIG was donating to the National Bureau of Economic Research. And during that time, Martin Feldstein made over $6 million from AIG. And so it is not very surprising that he never wrote any articles about the dangers of credit default swaps.
Here is your exchange with Harvard economics professor Martin Feldstein.
You've written a very large number of articles about a very wide array of subjects. You never saw fit to investigate the risks of unregulated credit default swaps?
I never did.
Same question with regard to executive compensation, the regulation of corporate governance, the effect of political contributions.
I don't know that I would have anything to add to those discussions.
That's a clip from Charles Ferguson's Academy Award-winning documentary, Inside Job. Ferguson's investigation took him to Wall Street, Washington, and the Ivory Tower. He detailed how academics promoted companies in reports but did not divulge their financial ties to the firms. This also applied to countries like Iceland. Iceland deregulated its banks, which immediately started an out-of-control borrowing and spending spree. Iceland's banking system soon crashed. Here's more of Robin Young's conversation with Charles Ferguson, starting with a clip from Inside Job, where Ferguson is asking Harvard University's Economics Department Chair John Campbell if professors who don't disclose are like doctors who work for drug companies.
I think it's certainly important to disclose Well, I think that's also a little different from cases that we're talking about here because
Charles Ferguson, John Campbell literally sits looking into the distance, seeming stunned for several seconds. All the academics you speak to seem so surprised that you'd even ask them about disclosure.
Yes. One thing that I realized and that surprised me was that they'd never been asked about this issue before. And in fact, even more generally, I came to realize that these people were not used to being challenged, period. They were used to being deferred to by their colleagues, by their employees, and also, I regret to say, apparently by the media as well.
Here's another scene. Help me set this up. This is Frederick Mishkin, an economist, professor at Columbia Business School. He was also a member of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve from 2006 to 2008. And he was one of those American economists who'd written a glowing report for the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce about Iceland, praising Iceland's financial sector just before, as we said, the entire country collapsed. You found that he had, what, changed the title of that report?
Yes, he had. He had changed the name of the report from Financial Stability in Iceland to Financial Instability in Iceland on his resume.
Let's hear his response to your questions about that.
On your CV, the title of this report has been changed from Financial Stability in Iceland to Financial Instability in Iceland.
Oh, well, I don't know. Whatever it is the thing, if it's a typo, there's a typo.
They seem stunned that there might be questions about this.
And I myself was stunned that they were stunned. Mm. I had never met Frederick Mishkin before. I'd never spoken with him before the interview. And I was stunned at what I found. I really was. That somebody who was so ignorant of such important things and who had such obvious conflicts of interest.
He was paid how much by Iceland?
He was paid $124,000 to write that report in 2006. That somebody with those characteristics would be appointed to the Federal Reserve Board and would be regarded as a very distinguished professor, one of whose subjects, by the way, is ethics and conflicts of interest in finance. He has written one of the most prominent and widely used textbooks of finance in the United States in business schools.
So, Charles Ferguson, you leave us pretty depressed at the end of this film, because everywhere you look within this huge system, Washington, where you have people from Wall Street who slid over to jobs in Washington where they make decisions that benefit, friends they left behind in Wall Street. The academic world, where we assume there's dispassionate thinking about the economy. The SEC, which has been gutted. You know, it seems as if every bit of the infrastructure of the financial world is interlocked and tainted.
Unfortunately, I think that there's a lot of truth to that now. This, however, is a relatively recent phenomenon. The financial world and its role in America and its power has changed very dramatically over the last 30 years, but it occurred gradually, step by step, year by year, and I think went unnoticed by many people, and including, I have to say, by myself. I was really quite shocked at what I found when I started doing the research to make this film. And now it's going to take a lot of time and energy and a big political fight to change this. You know, examples from American history that might be relevant or related might be the rise of the progressive movement a century ago in response to the rise of the robber barons. Another possibly relevant example is the rise of the environmental movement or the rise of the civil rights movement beginning a half century ago. You know, these things took time. But I'm optimistic that it will, in fact, occur. Of course, I wish that it would occur faster. I wish that President Obama had taken the chance that I think he had when he was elected. That's very sad because I think he had a very unusual opportunity in American history, and now that opportunity has passed, it's going to be a much more difficult, much more gradual process to fix this problem.
Charles Ferguson, his new documentary is Inside Job. His previous documentary was No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq. Charles, I just want to ask you, you don't come at this from a reporter background. I understand you founded an internet company. So why did you do this?
I did it for several reasons. Filmmaking is my third life. High technology was my second. My first was I was a political scientist. I got a PhD in political science at MIT, actually. And my PhD thesis advisor, to whom the film is dedicated, he died earlier this year, was a very eminent economist, Carl Kazin, from whom I learned a great deal, including some economics. And so making this film was in some ways hearkening back to my being a policy wonk 20 years ago, which I, you know, once was.
Well, and it's a reminder, too, that there are voices out. Well, his has been stilled, but there are voices out there.
Oh, there are many. There are many. Despite everything that the financial services industry has done, there are many good, well-intentioned, honest, ethical people in academia and also, by the way, in finance. Since the film was released, I've had a considerable number of, in some cases, very senior, very successful people in financial services come up to me privately and say, you know, you're absolutely right. Thank you for making this film. And of course, if I were to say this publicly, I'd get fired tomorrow morning.
That's Oscar-winning filmmaker Charles Ferguson. He spoke with Robin Young last November. His film, Inside Job, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And we have this final Oscar note. David Seidler, in accepting his award for The King's Speech, pointed out that he was the oldest person to have won an Academy Award for an original screenplay. However, when David spoke to Robin in January, he mentioned that he wouldn't be the oldest person to win for writing a screenplay, but the 73-year-old Seidler would be close.
The only one who would surpass me would be my literary idol, George Bernard Shaw, who won when he was 82 for adapting Pygmalion.
Not bad company.
But it proves that, you know, the mature writer has something to give. If you've still got a brain, you can still be a pain and make a contribution to the art and commerce of film.
George Bernard Shaw won for an adapted screenplay. To hear our interview with David Seidler, go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also hear other interviews we've done about Oscar-winning films. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again here and now.